The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Lenore Skenazy, author of the new book, Free Range Kids, Giving Our Children the Freedom We Had Without Going Nuts with Worry. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Maybe it's that after a gorgeous temperate spring, the heat has finally arrived in southern Arizona and my blood is warming up. Maybe it's my natural tendency to be combative. I once received a punching rabbi puppet from a friend I co-chaired a committee with, still a treasured possession. Maybe it's that there's just a lot of things going on in my part of the world right now that provoke a passionate response from me. But I have been entering into one fray after another in recent weeks, boldly charting a controversial new course for Two Jewish. Not that I haven't always taken on hot topics on Two Jewish, but somehow seem to be generating more heat than usual of late, as all faithful listeners of Two Jewish should know. And don't you all fit into that category, faithful listeners? Last week, I talked extensively about the new for-profit exhibit here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, called Bodies. I had many unfavorable comments to make about displaying cadavers in the way this exhibit does, especially cadavers that were acquired from the Chinese government and might have been the corpses of prisoners sold against their will after their death. As you may expect, after a lot of thought, I think the whole thing is more than a little reprehensible, and I said so. And so, in an electronic sense, my mailbox was full this week with your comments about my monologue on the subject of how we ought to treat human remains properly, and I appreciate the many favorable comments I got. Actually, some of the mail was of the envelope and stamp variety, so the term mail bag in the old-fashioned way still obtains. Anyway, you generally agreed with me that the public display of plasticized corpses without consent for profit was a kind of obscenity. Thanks. It was nice to hear so many positive responses about what I said, even if what I said was kind of negative. On the other hand, the responses I got when I spoke about SB 1070, the Show Us Your ID immigration bill that the state of Arizona passed a couple weeks ago, prompted a variety of responses, some very supportive, one or two critical, and one overtly hostile. That response was directed to the station manager instead of me. Interesting. I always appreciate those folks who can criticize me to my face, or at least to my own email, rather than going behind my back. It's much more Jewish to kvetch and even yell and scream directly at somebody, and it's more likely to get a positive response, at least from somebody Jewish, I think.
Teach your children well.
Well, this week I'm going to get up on my soapbox and yell and scream about another subject that is very near and dear to my heart, education. I've been on the graduation circuit this past week, 9 graduation experiences, count them 9, including my son Boaz's graduation from middle school and my son Gabriel's graduation from elementary school. So education is very near and dear to my heart. Actually, the word rabbi means teacher, more or less, and that's mostly what I do. So of course I care about education. But the truth is that in the current economic climate, education is getting hammered. Federal, state, and local appropriations for education are plummeting as governments try to find some way to balance their precarious budgets, and teachers and educators of every stripe are being laid off or asked to teach more students for less money. It's not pretty. And from a Jewish perspective, that is not just short-sighted, but wrong. For high-quality, free public education is the essential tool that helps create a responsible and ethical citizenry. It is the backbone of our society and is inherently Jewish. Although not widely known, we Jews invented free public education, and we did it 2,500 years ago. When Ezra the scribe led a group of Jews back to Israel from exile in Babylon, he was a kind of free rabbi, he discovered that the returnees didn't know what was in their own Torah. He began the process of publicly reading and later translating the Torah every week, first on Shabbat and festivals, and then on market days, too. That's why we chant Torah so often and so publicly. Purpose was not ritual. It was to make sure that our people learned and understood the greatest text ever written, the one about morality, ethics, mutual responsibility, holiness. It was a way to regularly provide basic education to everyone of any age and economic status, free of charge. The purpose of such education was and remains to create a responsible community that shares the same values. It's also a way to help a citizenry understand and respect the laws of our people, and to have mutual celebrations and days of observance that connect us culturally. That is what makes a community cohesive and valuable. Well, we Jews know better than any other group, perhaps, the value of learning. There are more words in Hebrew for learning and teaching than for nearly anything else. As people who care about this world, as Jews, it is our responsibility to speak out for education and to seek to direct our representatives to convey funds to support it, and to support it ourselves with our own funds too, even in these challenging economic times. When we come back on Too Jewish this fine morning, our guest will be Lenore Skenazy, who thinks kids today are far too coddled to develop properly. Find out what a free-range kid is when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-oneg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning Lenore Skenazy. She is a nationally syndicated columnist whose work has appeared everywhere from the Washington Post to Mad Magazine. Former op-ed writer at the New York Sun and the Daily News, she wrote a piece in 2008, Why I Let My 9-Year-Old Ride the Subway Alone. The ensuing media frenzy led her to create a book, blog, and parenting movement, Free Range Kids. FreeRangeKids.com, for those of you scoring at home. She now gives free-range lectures here and abroad. Skenazy is also the author of a trivia quiz book that puts the fun in short-term memory loss. And who know you could do that? Who's the blonde that married what's-her-name? Good morning, Lenore.
Hey, good morning to you.
All right, so, you know, start with a very important question to me. I always wanted to get into Mad Magazine when I was, you know, about 11. Is that something you're proud of?
Did you notice that I put it in my official bio? Yeah.
It is extraordinary.
Above anything else like college or family? Yes, I'm very proud.
Even ahead of your free-range kids?
Ahead of everything. And you know what? It was hard to get into MAD. I mean, I think I had ended up with like two or three pieces in MAD, but you know how many I ended up in Cracked? Remember Cracked?
Yes, I do.
Well, Cracked had much more forgiving editors. And believe it or not, my editor from Cracked is now my editor who moved on to Reader's Digest, and so I write for them. So
wow.
So it goes.
Boy,
yes, I'll
tell you,
we all graduate.
We're learning the magazine world this morning on Too Jewish. all right, so what's a free-range
Jewish too. What a surprise, a funny Jew.
It had to be, yes, because, you know, that's sort of an upset. That's like a
yeah,
short Jew, you know, it's really an unusual situation.
Yeah, I never hear about that. Yeah. How about a professor? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, hardly any of those.
Or rabbi.
What kind of a job is that for a good Jewish boy? So what's a free-range kid?
Free-range kid is a kid who gets to grow up probably the way you and I did, you know, going out after school and playing kickball or going to the park or knocking on a friend's door instead of having parents make the play date and organize it and bring the snack.
You mean stealing hubcaps and, you know.
Yeah, well, that's you know, sort of advanced study. That's like a graduate student in free range. People think free range and freewheeling are the same, but if they knew what an actual, I think I'm like sort of a normal, nervous Jewish mom about everything else except letting my kids outside. I mean, you know, I believe in helmets and car seats. And when my son turned 10 and we had this fun football party for him, the one goodie bag present I gave was mouth guards, protective mouth guards for all the school. Woohoo!
Oh,
there's
boy.
A woman who's into stealing hubcaps. You know, if free-range kids are just kids who are given the same amount of freedom and care that we were given.
That's a great concept, and we will explore it much more thoroughly with Lenore Skenazy, the delightful blog author of freerangekids.com and a book and a whole parenting movement, when we come back a little later this morning on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there, the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular podcasts. This is Memorial Day weekend, once a solemn and serious time to commemorate our war dead, now a good excuse to start the summer and head off for vacation. It's true that the actual observance of Memorial Day has declined to the point that it seems to represent not much more than a great weekend to start barbecuing and having pool parties, to shop for bargains at department stores and big box retailers, or head off to the cool weather of the beach. But that's actually a bit of a shame. For remembering our honored dead is a kind of moral responsibility, and it has great resonance in Jewish tradition. Our American Memorial Day began in New York State a year after the end of the Civil War, 1866, when communities started to observe Decoration Day to honor the dead of that great conflict. Within a couple of years, the observance had become national and near universal, a sign of the broad sense of loss the terrible American Civil War had created. While the concept of a specific Memorial Day may only date from the 1860s, the idea of having a specific time to remember and honor the dead is an idea that is particularly normal for Jews, and it has been for many hundreds of years. 4 times a year, we Jews observe a special service called Yizkor that allows us to remember those we have loved and lost. In addition, there are two specific Jewish versions of Memorial Day that are more contemporary commemorations: Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Yom HaZikaron, the Israeli Memorial Day, both in the late spring. In fact, you could say that we Jews have a certain affinity for the somber observances of Memorial Days, perhaps because we have so often lost people early under tragic circumstances. So we all do well to take a few moments to remember those who, in Lincoln's timeless words, gave their lives that that nation, our nation, might live. We welcome our Mavinta, our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Lederman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Well, thank you, and a happy one to you and yours as well.
Thank you. And, you know, this is, of course, the classic weekend for barbecuing and cooking outdoors, which raises Jewish questions.
Well, let's put it this way. If you're going to be a traditionalist, you're going to limit the cheeseburgers on this weekend. But that's not necessarily the case for all Jews, and I think it's a good time to talk about it. You know, we have a list of prohibited foods and permitted foods in Judaism. As a matter of fact, I always like to think that Jews have the proud distinction of being the first group to claim an official food fixation. It might not have been low-fat or high-protein or vegan, but it was certainly kashrut. And we have something that we talk about when we look at kashrut as really an honor, a sanctity, a sense of importance that we give to food, not in the way that a Jewish mother says, eat, eat, but in the way that we look at food as really a representation of how we honor God and the commandments. And, you know, it starts with the notion of what we can eat from the very beginning of time. In Genesis, God gave Adam only fruits and vegetables and plants to eat. And it really wasn't until after the flood that meat was put on the menu for all of mankind. But as time evolved and as the Jews wandered in the desert, the Israelites were given a list of forbidden foods, which today we know as animals that don't chew their cud and have split hooves, so we don't eat camels, pigs, horses, rodents, those kinds of things. We don't eat birds of prey or shellfish or fish without fins and scales. And then, of course, in addition to those very specific things, there was this general restriction that we quote from Exodus, you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And this has really evolved over time. You know, we talked last week about the receiving of the Torah and how revelation can continue to come to us over time in our own personal lives. Well, in a sense, revelation comes to us over time also through the rabbinic mind and interpretation that we honor and hold as sacred in the Talmud and in the continuing words of our rabbis and sages down to this day. And kashrut is a wonderful example that we can look at to show how the evolution of Jewish law has developed over thousands of years. I mean, not boiling a kid in its mother's milk. What does that really mean? First of all, do you have a kid with a little pink ribbon on it so you know that this kid is attached to the mother with the pink ribbon on it? Of course not. So the very first concern is going to be which kid has which mother's milk. Well, the rabbis knew that was a problem, and they had to deal with that. So what they did was they put a fence around the fence, so to speak. They broadened the net, and they said, well, what we're going to do is really separate the use of the eating of milk and meat, the use of the same plates to prepare milk and meat dishes. Of course, that's evolved over time. So, you know, not only are you forbidden to eat the two at the same meal or prepare the two in the same pot or serve them on the same plate, but then it became a rabbinic distinction to differentiate the period of time between which you would eat your meat and your milk. Some Jews today wait 6 hours, some wait 3 hours, some wait one, some don't wait at all and don't care. But the point is that as society developed and as the idea of understanding what that would mean, so did Jewish law. And I'd like next week to talk about the development of Jewish law and kashrut and take a look at eco-kashrut and some of the other things that are happening today.
And how that consciousness of food can become moral choices today. Thanks,
exactly.
Amy. We will talk next week. Have a great weekend.
Great. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wadler of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos is the finest restaurant in the Southwest. J-Bar are the most fun in all of the Southwest, I'd say, but they're also great places to hear music in the summer.
I think that's one of the things that makes J-Bar and Janos so fun in the summer is the summer music series. We have music every Wednesday and Thursday night out under the stars. And it's a really busy time, a really fun time for us, and great musicians, local musicians, but local musicians who also tour all around the world, and we get them at J-Bar.
You can sit outside, look at the stars, eat great food, have a drink, and just enjoy the summer with the Summer Music Series at Janos and the J-Bar.
And I'll see you there, Rabbi. Give us a call, 615-6100, and we'll have your table ready for you out under the stars listening to the music.
And eating and drinking. What's the website?
www.janos.com. The full summer music schedule's on the web.
JNOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked last week about the Italian Jewish community. You explained how it's not really the Italian Jewish community. It's the Milanese Jewish community, the Roman Jewish community, the Venetian Jewish community. Let's talk a little bit more. We started in the north of Italy and places you might go on your summer vacation and find Jewish sites. The ghetto of Venice must be the number one Jewish tourist attraction in the whole of Italy, even beyond the Roman synagogue. Fascinating place. Let's talk about the Venice, sort of this really important Jewish community.
Right. Probably a draw between the Jewish ghetto or former Jewish ghetto in Rome and the Jewish ghetto in Venice.
Better artichokes in Rome, but not this season.
Right. But what's interesting about Venice, of course, is that it was an empire in its own right. Long after the Roman Empire was gone, Venice controlled much of the medieval world, had extensive commercial interests, ranging as far as Istanbul and all through the coastal towns of what today are Croatia, Montenegro, Albania, Greece, Turkey, et cetera, et cetera. And as the Venetian Empire shrunk, Jews remained in all those outposts, but also sent money home, quote unquote, home to Venice. So there was a rich, important Jewish community there, which survived the Inquisition, survived all the indignities of the Middle Ages, survived the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 and all this stuff. And when Italy was unified and the modern nation state of Italy was born and secularized, Jews had no reason in particular to leave Venice. The community there is rather small, not important numerically, but definitely important historically. And there's a lot to see. I mean, there's old synagogues, there's the ghetto. I think there's a kosher restaurant there. So it's one of the places which has a rich history that is different from the history of the Habsburg Empire, different from the history of the Roman Empire. And as in the case of most Italian Jewish communities, really kind of sui generis. And there are other places in the north also worth seeing, Ferrara, Ravenna, Padova, all these great things that were once city-states, in fact. The Garden of the Finzi Contini's, great novel, great movie, takes place, I believe, in Ferrara, if I'm not mistaken. And all these places have remnants of a Jewish past, if not much of a Jewish present. I mean, the present major Jewish communities are definitely Milano and Rome. I think historically, Venice is probably the next most important place. But we should talk maybe next week about Rome in particular, and then also about the South, Naples, Sicily, whatever, which also have different pasts, but pasts in which Jewish communities played a major role.
Absolutely. We will continue this next week, Tom. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi, a priest, and a minister have their houses of worship side by side. Each congregation gets its clergyman a new car, a Buick for the minister, a Cadillac for the priest, and a Lincoln for the rabbi. But gas prices are high, so they decide to share the wealth in carpool. On the first day, the other two are shocked to see the pastor lay his hands on the hood of the Buick and pray. "What are you doing?" the priest asks. The pastor looks up. "I'm dedicating the car to the Lord's service." "Good idea. Be right back," the priest exclaims, runs into his church, comes out with a scepter on a short stick, and shakes water out of it onto the Cadillac. The rabbi stares. "What are you doing?" he says. "I'm consecrating it with holy water," the priest replies. "Good idea," the rabbi says, runs into the synagogue tool shed, comes out with a hacksaw, and cuts 2 inches off the tailpipe of the Lincoln. You know, you can never go wrong with a good circumcision joke. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature Too Jewish just for you and for our producer, Walker Ford. You should live and be well. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. So just as we had a little run of Chelm stories of fools, here we're going to have a run of smart stories that are showing someone in particular, a rabbi, you may be happy to know, being very clever. And the first one, collected by Stephen Schenken, says that there were these two merchants who were friends, and one day they were walking back down the road towards their hometown after having been trading in a separate town, and they happened to find this little baggie of gold coins. And as they saw it, they looked around for some other owner, and when they found none, well, the one friend Yossi, he said, "Well, we should take it and split it between us." And Shmuel, who was rather shrewd, he said, "Yes, we should split it, but you know, we wouldn't want to spend it all at once, and so maybe to make sure that we take our time, we'll each take a gold coin now, and then we should take this little bag and hide it in that hollow tree over there, and when we decide, we can come both of us back here and take another gold coin as we want." And so, well, Yossi sounded good to him, and the two of them took a gold coin and placed the bag in the hollow trunk of the tree and returned to their hometown. But Shmuel, the shrewd one, he had a plan. That very night, he returned to that hollow tree, took out the whole bag of coins, and kept it for himself. So that the next time Yossi approached him and said that they should both get another gold coin, well, the two of them made their way to that tree, Shmuel acting innocent, and they each reached into the trunk trying to find the bag, but not succeeding. And Yossi, in shock, he said, "Shmuel, there's no one else who has known about this tree, who knows our secret, and I can't imagine that someone would reach in here by chance. I hate to say it, but it must have been you who took the gold. Is it true, my friend?" And Shmuel said, "How dare you accuse me? It was definitely not me. It was you." And Yossi, who knew he hadn't stolen the coins, well, he argued his case, and finally the two of them decided to take it to the rabbi. But before they did so, well, Shmuel quickly slipped home on the pretense of having left something behind. And there he convinced his old father, who was a very good and decent man, to go and hide in the hollow trunk of that tree. And the old father, well, he resisted at first, but Shmuel finally convinced him, and he said, "You don't need to worry about anything, just say, Yossi did it." Well, the old men went and hid in the tree, and Yossi and Shmuel approached the rabbi. And as they started arguing their case, the rabbi said, "Well, let's go to the scene of the crime and see what it is." And so they approached that tree. And as they got close, Shmuel said, "Rabbi, just go and ask the tree. And I promise you, I am so certain of my innocence that I promise the tree will tell the answer, will tell the truth." And so the rabbi shrugged his shoulders and he walked up to the tree and he said, "Okay, tree, if you've got an answer for us, tell us who stole the gold coins out of your trunk." And from the depths of a tree, a small voice said, "Yossi did it." And the rabbi was rather startled, but the gears were ticking in his head. And he turned to Yossi and he said, "Yossi, I'm afraid that the tree has spoken and you are guilty." And Yossi said, but this can't be, said the rabbi. "No excuses. Now, as for the tree, though, if the tree knew that you did it and didn't turn you in and didn't even report the matter, then clearly the tree is as much to blame as anyone else, and so the tree should be burnt down as a symbol to all other trees. Right now, in fact." Well, of course, the old man from inside heard this, and he said, "No, no, no," and he popped his head out. And so Shmuel's ploy was revealed. Cleverly by that rabbi.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the Book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land and see if it can be captured. The spies take a month, and they see the whole land. Report back to Moses, the land is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it needs to be carried by two men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything will be great, only it's not. 10 of the 12 spies report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance, in spite of God's support. Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report saying that with God's help the land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why did you take us from slavery to kill us here at the hands of our enemies?" It's at this point that the decision is made by God. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in one generation. And so, after a failed, leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval or Moses' leadership, the people are condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new, young generation will emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a mentality of freedom. It's a great lesson in the process required to cleanse the trauma of oppression and failure from the minds of a community. Often it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or a country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning things can be done differently and that freedom is a birthright. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and find out how you can raise your kids without all the restrictions and end up with, well, free-range kids. Learn about it from our guest, Lenore Skenazy, when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Hundreds of Hebrew University students marched from their Mount Scopus campus in Jerusalem to the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah to protest the eviction of Arab families. The protest, called "The Occupation Is Here, 3 Minutes from Mount Scopus," students were joined by dozens of university professors. They chanted slogans like, "We won't sit in class while rights are trampled," and "We won't learn civil rights with racism in Sheikh Jarrah." That neighborhood has seen weekly protests since two extended Palestinian families were evicted from their homes last August and Jewish settlers moved in. An Israeli court ruled they were Jewish-owned buildings. This is one of the largest Israeli student protests of perceived violation of Palestinian rights ever. In other news about Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been invited to the White House next week This time, he can enter through the front door. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, on a family trip to Jordan and Israel, met with Netanyahu in Jerusalem and extended the invitation. Netanyahu received the surprise invite after his schedule was already bringing him to Canada early next week to meet with Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Netanyahu will be at the White House this coming Tuesday. Keep your ears posted. President Barack Obama and Netanyahu had a tense meeting in March at the White House following a goodwill trip to Israel by Vice President Joe Biden that was interrupted by an Israeli announcement of new planned construction in an East Jerusalem neighborhood. But the atmosphere has improved in recent weeks as U.S.-mediated Israeli-Palestinian proximity talks have gotten underway, and the Obama administration has mounted its charm offensive, an aggressive outreach effort to Jewish groups to correct the perception it is hostile to Netanyahu and too tough on Israel. In other news, the rabbinical seminaries of three major synagogue movements, actually the only three major synagogue movements, are forging a groundbreaking partnership to train Jewish educators. The Jim Joseph Foundation announced last week it was giving a combined $33 million to the Reform Movement's Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, my alma mater, the Modern Orthodox Yeshiva University, and the Conservative Movement's Jewish Theological Seminary of America, JTS. The grant is aimed at helping the three seminaries get better teachers in the field of Jewish education and offer them superior training. As a stipulation for receiving the money, each school is required to use $1 million of the roughly $11 million it gets over the next 4 years to work with the other schools on figuring out how to market the field of Jewish education to prospective teachers and incorporating modern technology into Jewish teaching. Thanks to the Jim Joseph grant process, the presidents of the three institutions have spent more time together in the past 2 years than our predecessors did in the previous decade, said JTS Chancellor Arnold Eisen. I think it's historic that you have these three institutions and their leaders working together in this fashion. I think it's good for the Jews. Partnerships are helping to drive JTS, which announced early this month that part of its new strategic vision includes finding allies in the education sector. Hebrew Union College, HUC, has become a natural ally for the Conservative Movement Seminary. The schools are in the third year of offering a combined fellowship funded by Charles and Lynn Schusterman Foundation that brings together rabbinical students from both seminaries for a joint seminar. They are now also offering joint classes as part of their respective cantorial programs. But the Orthodox Yeshiva University has been a much tougher match for both JTS and HUC because of its intense theological differences with the non-Orthodox schools. Under the new initiative, each school will continue to teach its own brand of Judaism, of course, but they will cooperate on elements of the educational process that impact everyone. It's a message that Yeshiva University's president, Richard Joel, is very careful to make. The schools are working together on practice, but not content. There was a time, generations ago, when liberal Judaism was viewed as a threat because more people were at least nominally Orthodox. Liberal Judaism was seen as giving Jews a reason to leave Orthodoxy, Joel said. But I don't think that's the reality today. The issue isn't that liberal Judaism will steal people from the Orthodox. It is viewed as something that continues to urge Jews to know something about their own story. And in the interest of Klal Yisrael, the collective good of the Jewish people, this is a very positive development. Chances are it would not have happened without the current economic crunch, which has compelled all three seminaries to seek new funding sources and new ways to implement their visions. I agree with Arnie Eisen. This is good for the Jews. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest, Lenore Skenazy, nationally syndicated columnist whose work has appeared everywhere from Mad Magazine, my favorite, we've already talked about it, to The Washington Post. So you were an op-ed writer. You wrote this piece just about why you let your nine-year-old ride the subway. And that led really to a whole movement. You know,
that was just a strange, you know, I write columns all the time. In fact, when you called, I stopped writing one right now. But, you know, so I write columns all the time, and I just happened to write this one about letting the nine-year-old take the subway. And that night, I got a call from both the Howard Stern Show and the Today Show. And I thought, I guess I've hit a nerve.
Boy, if you got both of them, something was up. By the way, if we can stop you from doing work for a short period of time, then, you know, really our mission on this radio show is fulfilled.
You know, I do know that as a dad, when my kid got old enough to play with other kids, I thought they were just supposed to go out in the yard or go next door. And I was told about this new institution called the Play Date. And you know, I wanted to take them bike riding, and I was told, no, you know, you do that. You have all this equipment. You do it in a particular place. You can't. I thought, boy, I must. How did I ever survive childhood?
That's what we're all wondering. It's such a distinct difference between the way we were raised and the way kids are being raised today that if you get the DVD of the old issues of Sesame Street, it's called Sesame Street Old School. It shows highlights from, you know, the early years of Sesame Street, early 70s, with kids, you know, playing follow the leader outside without an adult and playing in an empty lot, you know, balancing on a piece of wood and climbing through a pipe and this and that. And before they're even allowed to show you these things, there's like a message comes on the screen at the very beginning of the tapes, and it says, for adult viewing only. Okay, so
wow.
What was a normal childhood back in the 70s or 80s is considered so litigiously terrifying and wrong that PBS cannot even stand behind it anymore. That's how much things have changed.
Man, so, I mean, some of this is probably to the good. You know, I remember my mom's seatbelt was her right arm every time she had to hit the brakes hard.
Oh, see, we always believed in seatbelts.
Well, we just
okay.
didn't have them yet. I'm old, but...
You know, I'm old, too. I think they probably got theirs, like, cobbled in. I mean, my mom really had a car seat, like, before anyone else. I come from good, safety-loving stock.
Right. So, is this... I mean, it must be somewhat good that kids are more protected, no?
Well, here's what's good. I mean, what's really great in terms of, you know, if you want to talk about the biggest protection from, say, the 1950s till now, it's disease. I mean, it was five times more children died between the ages of 0 and 1 in 1950 than die now. So really, the thing that's keeping us safest today is doctors and medicine and advances that way. And then I do think it's great that we have, you know, helmets for riding bikes, and I do love car seats. You know, I think those are a great thing to have in cars. But what happened is we just never got, I mean, like once you start going, what if a kid goes through the windshield and you say, oh, let's protect them, good. But then it's like, well, what if anything bad happens? What if a child ever, you know, hurts themselves while they're crawling? So believe it or not, now there are baby knee pads, literally knee pads that you, you know, pull over your screaming child's knees so that they won't be hurt when they're crawling. And then there are helmets for when they're toddling, not when they're riding a bike at 20 miles an hour, you know, on the street with cars. When they're literally toddling around your living room, you're supposed to be putting this thing around them as if, you know, as if nobody really survives that that particular stage of childhood. You're supposed to bring table toppers with you. They're little portable placemats that you can bring with you to eat at a restaurant as if you're eating in a leper colony. I mean, everything has just been made. You're supposed to be scared of pretty much every stage of childhood now. And the result is that we are afraid. And to the point where we feel just terrified to even let our kids pretty much do anything, and certainly terrified to let them walk out the door and do what you were just talking about before, knock on a friend's door and make a play date. A date to come out. Not even a date. How about just come out and play?
Hey,
here's a ball. Let's go.
Great. Can we play pickle now?
What's pickle?
Yeah. You know, I had to explain it to my children.
Yeah, you have to explain it to me. What is it?
Oh, it's running bases, we called it. In Southern California, called two guys have a ball, or a guy and a girl, whatever, two girls, and somebody runs back and forth, you try to tag them out. Of course, now you have to use foam-covered baseball gloves. And
Right. And there should be a
baseballs.
Referee, and there probably should be a traveling league.
I would think so, right? With only the best pickle players get to continue on, and you have to practice 3 hours a day under careful supervision with a spotter.
Right. One of the ladies I interviewed for my book, I was talking to her about something else, and then she started talking to me, well, frankly, what do you think of this? And she's saying that her son is a good swimmer, and his swimming coach, you know, noted this, you know, and maybe because he was flattering her and wanted more business, or maybe because he thought he had some good raw material there, he said, he's a talented swimmer, but unless you start doing this, you know, seriously, 4 days a week with practice sessions and then some meets on the weekends, you really is going to fall behind. And she said, I don't know, because, you know, he was in first grade, 6 years old, falling behind if he didn't do this four mornings a week. You know, that's like a Michael Phelps schedule.
Well, you know, that 8-year-old Olympics, it's just a couple years off.
It's so interesting because they can have Olympics, but are they allowed to do anything else? My book is just full of like these weird things that I discovered when I was trying to figure out how did our country get so scared. But like if you're a Cub Scout now, I heard from a lady whose son is in Cub Scouts, and the scout leader showed them, okay, this is a stick and this is a knife and this is how you whittle. And then he gave everybody a stick and a potato peeler. Okay, because they couldn't possibly be trusted with a knife, even though that's what he was teaching them, knife skills. But that was too much. And Girl Scouts aren't allowed to roast marshmallows unless one knee is on the ground, because otherwise, of course, you know, they've all been, like, pitching themselves forward into those fires.
That Girl Scout auto de fe experience that they get a special merit badge in.
It's almost worth it. Yeah,
well, you know, it's They're a nice badge.
You know.
Sure. When I was 10 years old, I took the bus two public buses with a transfer, 45 minutes to get to school.
Where were you?
In Los Angeles, you know, which isn't exactly known as the dark urban jungle, although, you know, it's a big city. Kids don't really do that anymore, do they?
Well, as I found out, it's considered unusual by a lot of people to allow your child to go on public transportation. And I think that's because the assumption used to be that, you know, most people are fine and nobody really cares about a kid, or if they do, they're sort of watching out for them, to most people are probably pedophiles, and if you sit next to one on a bus, chances are you'll end up groped and maimed, and therefore it's crazy to ever let our children get anywhere near anybody other than ourselves, our nannies, and the coaches. It really is... It's a dark, grim, and also wrong view of the world, in that when we were kids, or when most of us parents were kids, 70s or 80s, the crime rate was actually higher than it is now.
Yeah, much higher.
Yeah. It's actually been a fantastic 30-year drop in crime, you know, something that you don't hear a lot about on Nancy Grace.
Boy, I'll tell you. You know, what's funny is I remember I grew up a few blocks away from where the Watts riots reached. So it wasn't such a great area. But that's just kind of what we did. That wasn't considered such a big deal.
Nothing was considered such a big deal. I mean, what's interesting to me is that everything is such a big deal. I mean, pre-K is a big deal. And are you going to the right pre-K? And, oh, no, you didn't get in. And didn't you prep her? And what's the matter? I was reading, I subscribe to the parenting magazines just for a laugh these days because my kids are older. And one of them was saying, you know, even if your child is too young to hold a pen or crayon, it's not too soon to start teaching them letters. Just get the top of a shoebox and put some sand in it, because that's really what you want in your house, a shoebox filled with sand, and start tracing the letters. Right? That way, you know, they'll be ahead once they can hold the crayon.
So we've become really paranoid about our kids.
Right. Paranoid about them falling behind and paranoid about them getting hurt.
You know, my kids are in a school where they do a testing process for everybody in the school, and it has something to do with how much federal money they get.
Oh, everybody's in the school like that. Right.
Okay. So the week that they're in that, they cancel.
My kids are in it right now. It's last week.
Yeah, yeah. So they tell them what test taking, they prep them, they teach them test taking skills, which will,
right?
You know, serve them well, I suppose.
It might. I'll serve them for 12 years, I'll tell you that.
It will. And then they're told to get lots of good rest and have good nutrition, as opposed to what they're supposed to be doing, you know, with
the
us
rest
as to
the
rest
year,
of
right.
the time.
Stay up and do your homework.
They're permitted to bring chewing gum to school for some
Ooh.
Reason. Now, why that's good for test taking, but not okay the rest of the time, I'm not
that's
so sure.
That's really interesting. And do they blow bubbles?
I don't know. I wasn't allowed to observe, lest they feel too much pressure. But
Don't feel pressure. Go home and sleep.
My favorite part was they canceled the Little League games that week, lest the kids be too tired.
Oh, you're kidding.
And I thought, if I'm sitting there taking, if I'm a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old boy or girl, and I'm sitting there taking tests for 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah, you certainly don't want to run around after that.
Oh, no. I want to, you know, preferably be put to bed early with, you know, a compress.
Really? That way you and your grandmother can have the exact same schedule.
Right.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is I just read about another school that was doing poorly, apparently, on these tests, and therefore they've taken away recess. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be really good. That's really going to serve your kids another 20 minutes because they can't do well on the tests yet. Obviously, you're doing so well teaching them that another 20 minutes is going to really help. But people fail to see how important play is. You know, what's funny to me is that in arguing my case, I've found that I have to use the same ammunition that the fretful yuppies use on me. It's like, oh, it's not good for children if they're not in their, you know, mommy and me class by age 3 months, and if you wait till 6 months, then all the synapses have closed and it's too late. So now I'm starting to argue back. I'm like, well, have you seen any of the studies about how important free play is, that this is how you develop self-regulation, which is like a key word in child development now? And you know how a kid develops the self-regulation to not stomp off and demand
take
that everybody...
Take your ball home.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You develop that by playing with a friend or friends and having to make teams yourselves and having to decide if the ball is in or out yourselves and having to decide the rules of the game. And all of that stuff develops your communication skills and your compromise and your creativity, whereas if you're in that little league and they're telling you what position to play and now it's time to come in and you have to shake everyone's hand and then we have to peel the grapes and we have to chop them into quarters and I hope they were organic and now go home and get ready for your test, that's a different childhood. I don't think that's a particularly great childhood.
So how do we get out of this?
Besides reading Free Range Kids, which is chock full of tips.
Just, you know, to note, it's freerangekids.com, and going to that website will have no deleterious effect on raising your children, I promise.
Right. But I was actually recommending the book Free Range Kids now, because in the book are all these little tips, and I'll just give a couple of them right now if you
Please.
Want.
Please, absolutely.
One of the ones inspired by my own experience of my 10-year-old, I have to say it a little quietly, he's actually home. My 10-year-old called me one time just after I had left the house. He called me on my cell and said, Mom, and I was like, oh, no, what? And he's like, can I eat another piece of banana bread? He said, hey, stop talking about me. And it was that was when I realized that, yes, he should be doing this. You know, he should be making his decisions. I shouldn't be telling him what to do. It's banana bread. It's not, you know, there's a beer in the fridge, Mom, which will be soon enough now that he's 14.
Yeah.
And so I realized if you keep your cell phone off or really home for a day, because if it's off, you'll just turn it back on, you know, then kids start having to make their own decisions again. So that's one simple idea. Another idea is that one of the reasons we're so terrified these days is because television has gotten way more scary than it was in my parents' day when they were raising us. There's actually not one episode of Law and Order that could have even been shown on television before 1981 when some standards changed.
Right.
So it's really, you know, it's more graphic, it's violent, it's, you know, kids being dragged off the street and raped and sold into slavery, whatever. So it's scary, and those images, even if you know they're fiction, they still sear themselves on your brain. So sear something else on your brain. Go outside for that hour you're going to watch Law and Order or CSI, and remember why you moved to your neighborhood. You know, you moved there probably because you wanted to be there, and yet if you're never letting your kid out in it, you might as well just move to a cheap slum, you know? Save some money. You're going to keep them inside anyway. But if you like where you're living, connect with it. And the more you connect with it, the more you're living in the real world and not the scary, terrible world of TV. And you'll feel safer. Your kids will be safer because you'll know your neighbors. They'll know where the store is that they can run into if they're ever, God forbid, followed by the man in the white van, because you know that predators only have white vans.
I did know that, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the commercials. So why not, live in the real world instead of the one that we watch for 4 hours and 50 minutes a day, television?
Great advice. I want to thank Lenore Scanese for a terrific visit. The book is called Free Range Kids, and the website is www. Why we say that, I don't know. You
yeah,
need
really,
to type
please.
It. But anyway, freerangekids.com. Thanks so much, Lenore.
Oh, thanks, Rabbi. Great chatting.
My pleasure, and good luck with that 14-year-old.
Yeah, I got to go see him. Bye.
Bye-bye. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest. Get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation.
Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Rabbi Robert Kravitz, Jewish chaplain in Phoenix with city and state police departments, talking about that interesting and important and challenging work. Our playout this morning comes from the vocal choir Musica Hebraica out of Canada. It's the lovely Samachti Beomrim Li, Charles Davidson's composition. I rejoiced when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Indeed. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.